Do you think there are any other people that have followed you very closely through Joy Division of New Order that will be disenchanted with the danceability of your newer material?
But I mean, we're not really here to represent the needs of our fans. We're here to write music, not to live up to somebody else's ideals.
We don't want a dedicated, loyal, you know, we'll buy anything following. I want is people who, if they like a song, they'll buy it. If they don't like the song, they don't buy it. That's the only principle we've ever worked on.
Hello and welcome back to Death with a Record. Can you believe it? It's the season finale already? Well, neither could we until we decided it was going to be. So what better way to end series two of the show, we thought, than one of the best bands of the 80s and one of the most significant groups coming out of the great city of Peterborough. Wait, sorry, I've read my notes wrong. That was the great city of Manchester, I meant. Sorry, same difference, really. Anyway, the album is Power, Corruption and Lies. The band, of course, is New Order. And the year the album was released is 1983. Ollie, do you want to kick things off with Year in Music as per usual?
Amidst the backdrop of Thatcher's re-election, the Cold War and nuclear fear, it would be fair to say the world was in a pretty shitty state in 1983. But rather than get bogged down in a turbulent year, let's just run through some of the albums that caught our attention. I reckon a good place to start would probably be David Bowie's Let's Dance. This was produced by Nile Rodgers and certainly marked a shift in his career. It had some extremely popular hits. I was actually quite surprised to learn that the single Let's Dance is Bowie's only song to reach number one in both the UK and the US. Now, I imagine this next one isn't your absolute favourite Talking Heads album, Jamie, but definitely still worth a shout out. Speaking in Tongues. Do you have a favourite track from that record?
Girlfriend is Better will be up there, but if I'm on it, it's not really a competition because that album has This Must Be the Place on it, which is just one of the greatest songs ever written and definitely, I think, in the argument for Talking Heads' greatest ever song. So yeah, I mean, it's got to be This Must Be the Place, right?
Yeah, although I'm glad you gave Girlfriend the shout out as well, though.
Yeah,
I've got a few more debuts for you. Cybertron's Clear was released this year, which is now quite rightly recognised as a techno and electro reference point. R.E.M. brought out Murmur. But maybe the debut that surprised me most was the fact Pulp released It in 1983.
Wow.
So bearing in mind, you know, this is 12 years before Different Class won the Mercury and they were headlining Glastonbury, poster group for Britpop and all that. I had no idea they were releasing music back then, I'm not going to lie. Perhaps slightly more relevant for today, some of the biggest British synth pop acts had records out this year. Now, when I see these names, listen to their music or watch them on YouTube, they all seem almost painfully 80s. You know, the likes of Soft Cell,
yeah,
Gary Numan, Eurythmics, Depeche Mode. As a side note, you know, I understand that fashion is cyclical and it can be hard to predict what's going to be popular next week, but there are enough dodgy trims and outfits from this decade that we're not making any reappearances anytime soon. That much I'm sure about. Back to the music, despite the fact they all operated within the synth pop universe, if you like, none of those four artists I've just mentioned compare to the band that we're talking about today. Don't get me wrong, I love Gary Numan's Cars as much as the next guy, but let's be clear, it's nothing on Blue Monday. At least to my ears, please step forward, the best album of 1983, New Order's Power, Corruption and Lies.
I think it will come as no surprise to most of you that the event we must acknowledge before any episode about New Order and their early career is the death of Ian Curtis by suicide in May 1980, and then the subsequent dissolution of Joy Division. I think everyone knows this story by now, and if you don't, obviously I encourage you to read or watch any number of books and films about the subject. The film Control is great. I've been going through Stephen Morris's autobiography recently. That gives another account of the time. But regardless, after the tragedy, the surviving members of Joy Division, Bernard Sumner, Peter Hook, Stephen Morris, were faced with a problem. What do you do as a band when your image has been so dominated by one figure, a frontman with such a distinctive charisma, a distinctive style of singing and of performing, that people are literally still talking about 40 years later? How do you move forward without a person like that? And I think it's fair to say, they struggled at first. Movement, the first album that followed under their new moniker New Order, with the addition of Gillian Gilbert on synths, was once again produced with Joy Division producer Martin Hannett, Now, Bernard Sumner and Peter Hook have both noted that Hannett basically seemed to think that Ian was a genius and all the others were fucking idiots, which made working with him quite difficult, understandably. During the recording of the album, they were all experimenting with singing and who was going to fill the shadow of Ian Curtis. Hooky actually sung on the album's opener, Dreams Never End. Ollie, to start off, what do you think of Movement? I've heard it described as funereal in tone, which is probably a fair evaluation and, of course, quite natural given everything that had happened.
I absolutely adore that record, and
funereal
is probably the perfect way to describe it. Not only were these technically Joy Division songs, but as you can imagine, it was not exactly a happy vibe in the studio at the time. Like, yeah. The band had lost their talisman, but also their best friend. And Salford in the 1970s, I don't imagine that was the kind of place where people spoke openly about their feelings and emotions a great deal.
Mm.
But all the band members have said how this was a hugely challenging time, and they were all, you know, 22, 23, something like that.
So young.
Having said all that, I don't think Martin Hannett's behaviour made things easier in the slightest. Have you heard much about his antics in the recording studio around the time they were making Movement?
Well, I know he was a huge heroin addict, right? I read something about eventually his addiction got so bad he weighed about 26 stone or something like that. It's quite a sad story. What was he up to in the studio?
I mean, he would basically lock himself in the tape storeroom with a bag of drugs and say to the band, if I hear anything I like, I'll come out and tell you.
Oh my God.
Needless to say, that didn't happen very often. And when he did leave the room, it would generally be to go pick up more drugs. And, you know, he'd get the band to do things over and over and over again, just saying, do it, not offering any guidance on how to change the track or improve it. And I remember Bernard Sumner recalls a time where he was recording the same piece of music for about half an hour with no input. And he stormed back into the control room to go mad and discovered that Hannett had basically fucked off a long time ago to go home.
Oh, wow.
You know, clearly it was a fraught time for the band, but it's very little surprise to me that once they got rid of Hannett, the music became so much lighter.
Yeah, it's funny. Tony Wilson notes that he was reviewing 24 Hour Party People, obviously the film about his life and about Factory. And in that film, Hannett was played by Andy Serkis, who, of course, famously played Gollum in Lord of the Rings. And I think Tony Wilson said something like, believe me, the strangest role Andy Serkis will ever play will be Hannett. It won't be Gollum, which I think probably says something about the vibe in the studio for sure. Yeah, and it's safe to say that New Order were going to have to overcome this shadow and develop their sound. And fortunately, that is exactly what they managed to do with the album we're chatting about today, Power, Corruption and Lies, released in 1983. Described by Rolling Stone as a quantum leap over Movement and over most of the music coming out of Britain at that time. Ollie, this was New Order properly announcing themselves to the world. So what strikes you as different about this album, both compared with Joy Division that we've just talked about and with Movement itself?
Genuinely, I think this is like night and day. I remember reading that Hannett used to like working in the dead of night and he was pretty much nocturnal. And in my head, that is the Joy Division sound. You know, we spoke last week about how Burial's music is intimately tied to South London at night. For me, it's the same with Joy Division and Manchester. And New Order post-Movement is completely the opposite. Like, I don't know if you've ever been to Macclesfield, where a few members of the band lived or went to school, but this album and their other ones from the 80s give me really strong Macclesfield vibes. You're basically, you know, fields, sun, rivers, just rural Cheshire, all very pleasant. And, you know, put it this way, if I had a time machine and could go back to the 70s or the 80s and watch either Joy Division or Movement era New Order, I'd want to be in a cold, dark warehouse, ideally in Salford. But from Power, Corruption and Lies onwards, I feel as though an open air gig in the sun would be ideal.
Yeah, I think that says a lot about the difference in sound between Power, Corruption and Lies and Movement and Joy Division, which weirdly can actually be traced back to their trips to New York in the early 80s. This is where the band were introduced to post-disco, Italo, Electro. And Bernard Sumner describes how that exposure to New York club music made them realise how stiff the clubs were back home in England, playing only disco. And he has this quote where he says that in New York we listened to the Sugar Hill Gang and African Bambaataa, and they had this incredibly eclectic style. After Chic, you'd hear a track from The Clash, and that was totally unimaginable in the UK at that time. And that's when we realised we wanted to hear our records being played in these New York clubs. We finally knew what we were looking to do artistically. From that point on, electronic music was the logical progression. To me, it's so weird to think, given all that is made of New Order and their connection to Manchester or Macclesfield, as you just mentioned, and to Factory, It was actually New York's DJs and the variety of music they played there that gave New Order, let's say, the final push to go in that direction. I mean, what do you think of that all?
It makes you realise just how vital those nightclubs were at this moment in time. Like, if you think about, you know, Paradise Garage and Larry Levan, right? Legendary resident there. They had an enormous impact on not only club culture and how the nightclub as an entity developed, but also the very direction of electronic music. And I find it kind of heartwarming, to be honest, because I know New Order had quite a traumatic first trip to New York where they basically had all their gear nicked outside the hotel because the roadies got in a massive fight with one another and buggered off. So I'm kind of glad they were able to head out to some clubs and be inspired by the music that they heard.
Have you heard about this? Because this apparently was quite a common thing I was reading. So English bands who'd go tour in the US back then, you'd get thieves who'd follow them, go to their gigs, follow the band's van back to the hotel, and then if the roadies got distracted or the roadies weren't paying attention, the thieves would go up to the van, pretend they were roadies themselves, and then just steal everything. So it apparently happened to like Pink Floyd back in the 70s as well, like various other bands back in that time just had all their stuff nicked by like organized crime in the 80s.
Yeah, I think it's also probably a good shout to mention the importance of the Hacienda here as well, because it's something we'll speak about a little bit later during Album Cover Nightclub. But I think the fact the band owned their own nightclub shouldn't be underestimated when we think about the change in their sound, and also how much the Hacienda was influenced by these New York nightclubs. I read a great quote the other day which said, "The band really woke up to their own potential when they bought a nightclub and started making music that might fill it."
Yeah, because in some ways it must have seemed a slightly strange idea at the time, or at least felt quite novel. You have these punk aesthetics and then you have dance music coming together like it did in New Order's music. Because you might have thought they'd be uneasy bedfellows, but I think the fact is it works for New Order because of how each individual member of the band contributes something unique to their sound and unique to the whole. Anyway, let's get on to the actual music. The single released alongside this album was, of course, Blue Monday, which didn't actually end up featuring on the record, at least not on the official version. To make another Beach Boys comparison, do you think this is another one of those situations where Sloop John B made it onto Pet Sounds rather than Good Vibrations? Blue Monday should have made it on perhaps in place of, I don't know, 5-8-6 or something like that. What do you think of their single choices, Al?
To be honest, I'm kind of happy that it's not on the record because, I don't know, I think about it, Blue Monday's, you know, the best-selling 12-inch of all time, widely regarded as one of the greatest songs ever. And the band are essentially saying, yeah, we don't need it on Power, Corruption and Lies. The rest of the tunes are sick enough. I kind of rate that cockiness, rate that bottle a little bit. Have you heard the funny story about how the sleeve design for Blue Monday ended up costing the band?
Yeah, so didn't it? It was like the most expensive sleeve to produce. So even though they sold, as you said, the best-selling 12-inch of all time, they ended up making barely any money on it or something along those lines.
Yeah, I think it was a piece of cardboard that had to be cut out the middle. So for every record they sold, it cost the band 10p. And, you know, think about how many they shifted. And everybody speaks about Factory being a badly run business. But even by their standards, that is absolutely shocking management.
There you go. That's Tony Wilson for you. The other day I was on Twitter, and this is just proof of the staying power of Blue Monday. It's one of the greatest songs ever, which I think is fair. It still goes off, so much so that some guy, I think Carl Cox, had just played it in a set in Ibiza somewhere, I don't know, but there are all these people who were retweeting a clip of the song being played by Carl Cox being like, oh, can I get a track ID on this banger? This one went off last night. And it's just like, oh my God, it obviously that's incredibly bait, but it's also in a way like, oh wow. So, I mean, you know, this many years on, it's still going off and having people desperately trying to find out what the song is. So that's kind of a nice reminder of the power of Blue Monday.
So Blue Monday's not on the album, but if you had to pick some of your favourite tunes from it, what are you going with?
I think I'd start by talking about Age of Consent. I mean, given all we've been saying about electronics and dance music, the fact that this opening song is basically proof that New Order can still do indie bangers better than anyone else. Because this, for the most part, right, is a song of bass guitar and drums besides those kind of pad synthy strings that come over in the chorus. There's a cracking performance of Age of Consent in the Radio 1 studio from 1984. You have Bernard Sumner wearing, for some reason, a sleeveless tank top and really, really short white shorts. He looks like he's about to like take a PE lesson as a PE teacher or something. He completely butchers the guitar part, not that it really, really matters, and then, you know, carries off an amazing performance. Hookie's there, looking cool, looking really nonplussed. banging out that signature bass line with that amazing tone. Stephen Morris is at the back, playing at 1,000 miles per hour and somehow keeping it going. And then you have Gillian holding everything together on the synths. That said, my favourite thing about this song comes about 3 minutes in, when Bernard Sumner just lets out this big yelp, the kind of like, and it reverbs, and then the whole band settles into this groove. To me, that is such a euphoric moment. It's definitely one of the best moments on the album.
See, as much as I do like that moment, and I like Bernard's guitar solo, mate, when Gillian's keyboard line comes in...
Yeah, it is amazing.
That is absolute magic for me. I don't think the track would be anywhere near as good without it.
What about you then? What would be your standouts?
My favourite song on the album, hands down, I'm going with The Village. You've got Gillian again stepping up with a killer synth line that I reckon any house producer working today would be pretty gassed to make something that sounds that sick. And, you know, she was doing it back in 1983. I think generally with New Order, they're not a group that are going to win any Nobel Prizes for literature. But there is a line on this song that I really, really like that goes, "Oh, our love is like the flowers, the rain, the sea and the hours." Okay, it might not be the most complex or striking, but I just think it's a really beautifully simple lyric. And, you know, imagine for one moment Ian Curtis singing something like that. And that, in a nutshell, shows the massive lyrical transformation that the group underwent. Oh, our love is like the flowers, the rain, the sea and the hours.
Yeah, the thing about The Village to me, you mentioned this, some of the synth sounds that they were getting. They sound so modern and so like buoyant and bouncy. It's hard to believe that this was the first album they self-produced. You know what this song reminds me of, actually, Ollie? It reminds me of I Can Change, the LCD Sound System song.
Yeah.
Not in terms of sound necessarily, but just the energy. And I think there are like hundreds of other indie dance anthems, whatever you want to call them, from the past 20 years, or particularly since the start of the noughties, that owe a lot to this song and to New Order.
If you had to pick one more song, Jamie, which are you going for?
Well, I would go with my favourite song on the album, which is Your Silent Face. You mentioned some of Bernard Sumner's lyrics, which can be at times, and I'm not sure how to put this nicely. In fact, I won't. All I'll say is that it's not Ian Curtis, is it? We all know what I mean. And on this song, there's a lyric where what does he say? It's like, "You've caught me at a bad time,
why don't you piss off?
Yeah. And it's kind of terrible, but it's also not, and it's as far away from Ian Curtis as you can imagine, but it works. And it's something about Bernard Sumner's delivery, that attitude of he doesn't care, that carries the lyrics through. I also think fundamentally this is a great ballad, because this isn't a case of, you know, electronic experimentation that after the fact is turned into a song, which I think is an accusation you could level at, you know, the occasional New Order song. To me, this is just a beautiful melody. It's atmospheric. There's those amazing synth sounds, and that all comes together to write a brilliant song rather than just being a piece of electronic experimentation.
It's definitely something that feels more composed, if that makes sense. Just like the way the body of synths seem to be working together in the chorus breaks. It sounds like a piece of synth pop classical music, if that makes sense.
Oh, I love that. That's beautiful. Yeah.
And I like it because I think it's a bit of a different tune on the record. Like stuff like The Village, Ecstasy, 586, they're the kind of songs I could imagine going off in a club even today. Your Silent Face, it's that bit more wistful, a bit sad, a bit down tempo, but as you say, still a beautiful piece of music. Sign that leads the way.
Apex is the segment where we try to put a band's discography into some kind of context and then eventually pick out our absolute favourite album of theirs, or in other words, their apex, the peak of the metaphorical mountaintop. Ollie, when it comes to New Order, I think their releases can be split into a few distinct phases or groupings. So if you'll bear with me for a minute, at the end, if you think I'm chatting nonsense, you can tell me, but if I'm onto something, you can tell me that too.
I'll let you go.
So I think that first grouping is made up of just one record, their debut Movement. As we discussed earlier, it's not quite a Joy Division record, but it's not quite a New Order one either. But it has some unbelievable moments and definitely bridges the gap between the two bands. Then you have the next group of records, which is all the other 80s albums. So to me, these are New Order's prime years. This is like Messi in Barcelona from like 2009 or maybe 2008 to 2018. This is when he was winning all the Ballon d'Ors. You've got Stephen Morris, Busquets, Hookied Piqué, Bernard's Messi, Gillian Xavi, Tony Wilson's Pep Guardiola.
Pep Guardiola.
The Power Corruption and Lies, Low Life, Brotherhood, Substance, which I think is important to put on there, even though it's technically a compilation album. And then you have Technique in 1989. I'm imagining we will find our apex somewhere in there, Ollie. The next grouping is the 90s and noughties albums. So Republic in 93, Get Ready in 2001, Waiting for the Sirens Call 2005, and Lost Sirens 2013. I think these are decent records with some good moments, but ultimately for me, nowhere near their peak. And I think they reflect perhaps some of the internal strife building between Peter Hook and Bernard Sumner, and then the departure of Gillian Gilbert, and then eventually Hooky too. The final grouping then is their single most contemporary record, Music Complete. Usually it's shaky ground when a band that peaked 30 years previously starts to release new music, but I actually think this is a great record and a real return to form. So, Ollie, I mean, first of all, do you agree with my little summary, or do you think I've been chatting stuff worthy of Stockport Refuge Centre?
In general, on this show, we tend to gravitate towards ridiculous analogies that make very little sense to anyone apart from you or me.
True.
But for once, this is absolutely not the case. I reckon.
Oh, nice.
The only thing I'm going to pick you up on is maybe we swap out Rob Gretton for Tony Wilson as Pep Guardiola.
Oh, okay, yeah, that makes more sense in terms of the manager.
As the manager.
Fair.
But yeah, apart from that, excellent work, Jamie. I really agree with how you've delineated those different stages. I was actually getting slightly worried when you brought up Music Complete that you were going to slag it off, so I'm relieved that isn't the case. I actually think the song Tutti Frutti from that record, which has a LaRue guest appearance on, might be one of my favourite New Order tunes full stop. And the fact it came out, as you say, 35 years after they first released the record, shows that as a band, they can still crank out decent music, and not many groups can say the same over that kind of time period.
It's quite a nice thought, because that song, particularly Tutti Frutti, reminds me very intensely of our first year of university, where a guy called Max Quarterman, who's a great friend of ours, played it first. That's the first time I heard it. And there's this symmetry of, you know, we're listening to that in our first year of uni in 2000, whatever it was. And then 30 years previously, our parents were probably listening to Blue Monday. Well, my parents certainly weren't, but maybe your parents were back in the day. And like, it's the fact that they can have that longevity is amazing.
That is sick. I'd actually never thought about it like that. That's fucking amazing.
Let's be more specific then. What would be their absolute apex pick for you and why, Ollie?
It's tricky, right? Because I think if we're going pound for pound tunage, then, which is a,
what
phrase,
a phrase,
I'm
fuck,
never saying
fuck
that again.
Fucking hell. Pound for pound tunage, please leave that in. That is the heavyweight pound for pound tunage. Oh my
then,
God.
I reckon Substance would have to be the clear champ, because you got Blue Monday, Ceremony, Temptation, sure. Everything's Gone Green. They're amazing songs, but it isn't a studio album, so I feel like I can't validly shout that as their apex. Until very recently, I would have gone with Movement all day long. When I was growing up, I was always listening to Joy Division rather than New Order, so I always kind of saw them as the OGs, the starting point, and then New Order as a bit of a side dish, which I'm not saying to trigger you, but it's more just about why I love the sound on Movement so much, obviously, because it's an early New Order record.
I understand. I'll accept that.
Over the last few months, I've made a bit of a U-turn. So do you know what? Oh, yeah. I'm actually going to go with Power, Corruption and Lies as their apex.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I think it set the band on a new path for a sound that they would perfect over the course of the 80s. I think in Age of Consent and The Village specifically, it's got a couple of my favourite New Order tunes. And I know we will come onto this later, but I think it has my favourite Peter Saville album cover as well.
Very nice. Okay. For me, I think I'd go with Brotherhood. That's the album where they split up the guitar-y songs and then the more danceable songs over two sides. So on the A side, you have five great indie tunes, and on the B side, you've got like Bizarre Love Triangle as the big single, and then you've got All Day Long and Every Second Counts, which are just synth pop. Or what do you call pound for pound synth pop tunage or whatever it was? So I'd go Brotherhood. But I think Power, Corruption, and Lies is definitely a reasonable choice. I mean, honestly, I think Low Life, and you could even talk me into Technique too as picks for their Apex. Any of those ones from the Barca years are pretty reasonable. Just to end the segment before it goes fully off the fucking rails, I know we've not discussed them in proper detail really, and you've alluded to it there as they were your way into New Order. If you had to pick a favourite of the two Joy Division albums, or if you want to include some of the compilations as well, fine. Pick a favourite album and pick a favourite song. Two words is all I need.
Tough one. I think I'd have to say The Best of Joy Division.
You twat.
These wings.
They're only the band the Beatles could have been.
Well, I love the Beatles.
Yeah, so do I.
What's your favourite Beatles album then?
Tough one. I think I'd have to say The Best of the Beatles.
I'm going with Closer and Transmission.
Speaking of Steve Coogan and that Partridge reference, obviously Steve Coogan starred as Tony Wilson in 24 Hour Party People. Have you heard the stories about Coogan and Courtney Love?
What? No.
All right, so I mean, I know sometimes Death of the Record goes to a bit gossip, Maggie, but I don't care because this is a funny story. So basically, back in the early 2000s, Courtney Love slept with Steve Coogan. And apparently she only did it because he'd played Tony Wilson, and she had this weird kind of daddy fetish about the Tony Wilson as a man. So since that fact, Courtney Love, whenever she has the opportunity, slags off Steve Coogan and says, you know, I think to quote, "The biggest regret of my life is sleeping with Steve Coogan. I only did it because he'd played Tony Wilson, and I thought in some way he was channeling the essence of Tony Wilson." So, I mean,
that is brutal.
When Courtney Love is making you look like that, then you really need to take a long, hard look at yourself. So, Steve Coogan, if you're listening, mate, not looking good for your fella.
What is often overlooked is that this really, really important band, which was Joy Division, evolved into a band and a girl joined. And you said, why should that be such a big deal? But this was 30-odd years ago, and they didn't get in some well-known musician. They got in someone who was close to home, and she was very enigmatic. But back in 1981, when they were on the cover of a magazine, she was uber cool. Nowadays, we are so used to a band with a girl playing keyboards. She was kind of the first to do that, as I remember it. And she played these cool little top lines, and then she'd put a guitar on and just looked very mysterious. And that added to the allure of the band. So you've got that, which is bringing that kind of cool, remote, mysterious femininity to it.
With this being the final episode of the series, you knew we had to pull out the big guns. We've been very lucky over the last few weeks to interview a range of musicians and music lovers, and Jamie and I are both grateful that they've shared their thoughts and opinions on the show. Today we're delighted to say we're rounding off Series 2 with another such figure. Now, we have a feeling some of our listeners will be familiar with our guest today. She's been very active on our social media page, particularly around the time of the Lily Allen episode, and generally has just been a massive help with Death with the Record from the very beginning. Jamie and I are really happy to have Galchester's founder and editor, Becky Burgum, on our Alternate Cut segment today. Becky and I have known each other a while, having gone to school near each other in Manchester.
And it was this city of Manchester and frustrations with its predominantly male identity that inspired Becky to set up Galchester, a magazine which she runs alongside her friend Hattie James Weed, already our friend of the podcast, who is the creative director at Galchester. Galchester champions Mancunian women, often working under the radar, giving them a platform to share their work and inspire others. The magazine highlights creative figures across art, design, fashion, film, photography, but importantly for us, music as well. So Becky, first of all, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you doing? Feeling very excited.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame not to have Hattie with you as well, but I'm glad that we have at least one half of Galchester represented today. I'm really excited to chat.
To kick things off, we'd love to know a little bit more about the origins of Galchester. What prompted you to found the magazine? When was it started? And
How has it grown since that point?
So I started it in 2018, and it was like print magazine as part of my final project for my fashion journalism course. And I feel like, especially moving to London, it's clear that the only thing that people associate with Manchester is kind of football, bands like Oasis, bands like Joy Division, New Order, blah, blah, blah. So we just cling on to the past so much. So I was sick of that. I was also sick of the London-centric nature of the creative industry. I want to show other women what kind of creative jobs exist and things. And since we launched, we've grown a lot more digitally, especially now Hattie's on board.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have been doing like sofa surfing, right, in lockdown. That's something that I've really enjoyed kind of checking out.
Yeah, exactly. We kind of zoom in to various creatives across the city and then find out about how they got to their position, kind of what they're all about. And yeah, in the hope that maybe people will use us as a kind of database to try and find, if they're looking for an illustrator or something, they'll come to Galchester, have a look, and then be able to find like all these great creatives.
Speaking about today's album, what are your thoughts on Power, Corruption and Lies, or New Order's music generally? I mean, obviously I know you quite well, we've had quite a few nights out, and you are a bit mental. Have you ever kind of found yourself doing something crazy to Blue Monday on the dance floor, maybe?
I'd say I've done lots of crazy things on dance floors, but not to that song. I feel like in general, my reaction would be quite an eye roll at this whole kind of album slash band. I just feel that mainly the kind of context and legacy is what puts me off the most, with so many boys banging on about it. I feel like it's a bit samey, a bit kind of wrapped up in the lad-centric Manchester atmosphere of the 80s. And like, is it good enough that we're all still talking about it? But saying that, I actually was this weekend in a gay club that was playing solely New Order and Joy Division. And I have to say that Blue Monday does slap. So, but I think that was not more the surroundings that impacted that.
I mean, you've kind of saved yourself at the end there slightly, but you've just taken a lot of shots at New Order. So I want to kind of find out why. You've mentioned it a bit already. Gillian Gilbert herself has been quoted as saying that New Order is a very laddish band. And even Bernard Sumner has admitted as much. He says, I think we are the way we are because we all grew up in Salford, which was the, you know, industrial heartland of Manchester. It's a working man's city within a city. You definitely hear that kind of thing a lot. Why do you think this idea of a laddish Salford or Manchester identity has persisted for so long? Because this was the 80s where this band were in their heyday, and it's still the same thing now, you know, 30 years later, right?
That quote just says it all, really. The role of women in kind of all aspects of the city has just kind of completely been erased. Mm. So obviously, what were the women doing in the working man's city? Like, I mean, they were working tirelessly behind the scenes the whole time, probably kind of even like that Hacienda, they were working behind actually making shit happen.
Yeah.
And in films like the 24-hour pod, people, like all the female journalists were edited out. And it's that kind of constant editing out that affects my opinions today.
It doesn't like allow a legacy to develop because there's never any like culture that expresses what things are really like.
Exactly. Like it's not written down anywhere because they all just decided that it didn't happen or just kind of never spoke about it. Manchester is the birthplace of the suffragette movement, but yet all we talk about is the bands. And I mean, it being in the textile revolution, like the Cottonopolis, but then the women were all working in those factories. The women kind of had such an important role for the whole time. We just don't talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, also like literally part of New Order, and one of the kind of most fundamental parts is obviously the way that they've incorporated synths into their music. And I feel like Gillian Gilbert herself has kind of been looked over in the history of the band too, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, yeah, I don't even know if most people would know that there was a woman in New Order, if
Absolutely
I'm honest.
Not, yeah.
All right, then just to kind of move across slightly to things on a bigger scale outside of Manchester as well. A few years ago, all three of us and some of the people as well went to Primavera Sound, I think in 2019. And one of the interesting things about that festival is their commitment to having the bill split 50-50 in terms of the gender of each of the artists. I mean, do you think this type of initiative is important? Also, having gone to the festival, do you think it made a difference to how the kind of people who went there, what the environment was like in the festival, the atmosphere? Is this the kind of thing that should just be, you know, without thinking, all festivals should be like this? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I really do. I feel like if you've got hardly any women on the lineup, it just becomes ingrained that female performers aren't worthy or good enough for the spot. And it's just in the back of our minds, when actually it's maybe because they haven't been spotlighted enough or they've not been able to build up a bigger name for themselves. I feel like it's very much like a cycle of kind of fake news, like, you know, like your social media bubble, it just has that impression. And then I feel like, especially in the pandemic, I feel like we've all reverted back to male-dominated festival limits. Like we've all forgotten about it. Like, the Wireless lineup this year was an absolute joke. Once again, I think there was maybe three female acts on the entire thing.
Jesus.
Obviously, I think you actually need to have this kind of 50-50 split as a rule, otherwise just to start off with, and then slowly it'll become something natural, but at the moment it's still so dominated by men.
Sometimes what I see on social media is when they have like a lineup for a festival and they just block out all the male names, and it's actually like fucking ridiculous to see just those two or three names on a bill. And I think it's good that festivals are kind of being shamed on social media for that kind of thing these days, because that definitely didn't happen when, you know, 10 years ago when I was at school.
Definitely.
I think it's interesting as well, now you pointed it out, you were really right, because I feel like the conversation in 2019, it was kind of going in the right direction with Primavera and there's other festivals who did similar stuff. And then in the pandemic, it feels like now we're all so elated to be going to festivals at all. The whole conversation has just been completely silent. No one seems to give a shit anymore, because it's like, oh, well, the festivals are back again, that's enough. Yeah, it's interesting, because it definitely, the conversation seems to be kind of going forward and backwards and never quite, you know, one step forward, two steps back kind of thing.
Binko, have you got any suggestions for future Death with the Record episodes? Any that you'd like to see us cover in the future?
First of all, I think Avril Lavigne is a timeless choice. So I really don't know why it's not been on before.
And then, true.
And then secondly, I think you need to do a girl band, Girls Aloud, Spice Girls or something, especially seeing as, so Little Mix were the first female band to win Best Band at the Brits this year, which is a joke, I think you'll agree. So
I can't believe that's true, yeah.
Exactly. So I feel like that's kind of got a perfect atmosphere you can work contextually around. And also some full-on pop like Britney and Christina is definitely, I think you need to open your mind and broaden your musical taste.
Were you a fan of the Lily Allen episode? Because that was one of the kind of first, I guess the first pop episode that we did. Did you enjoy that one?
Yeah, that was my favourite one. Bring it again. Bring a different Lily Allen album. I'll have it.
Okay.
Well, we're not doing cheeses. So I got in a lot of trouble for not giving Britney the respect that she deserved on Lily Allen. So I'm going to take this opportunity to say I was edited. It was a rage. I was edited out in the edit by Ollie. He has control of these things. So I actually sung her praises quite considerably. And then Ollie was like, you know what? He's just kind of trying to, you know, manipulate what the public and definitely the record audience think. So the reality is, obviously, love Britney, and I think that her father should be jailed. How about that? How's that?
Well, give us the extended cut, and then I'll believe you.
I will release the tapes. The tapes will be released one day, and my name will be cleared. But you know, not yet, unfortunately. That's Ollie has control of such things.
Binko, to finish things up, people listening today, where can they find Galchester? And what have you got cooking in the pipeline? Have you got plans for a second print magazine to come out in the future?
Yeah, so our Insta is at Galchester Mag and our website's galchester.com. We're continuing our digital series at the moment, but we're also going to start working on issue 2 next. So we always love people kind of DMing us suggestions of their friends or themselves. We like it to be quite collaborative, so please show us who you think deserves to be on there.
And then hopefully some point in the future we can have a proper Galchester X Death of the Record episode where you and Hattie come on and we do an album that all four of us love and just kind of talk about it for, you know, 45-50 minutes. How about that as well?
That sounds perfect. A little double date.
Love it. I can't wait. The tension's going to be palpable, yeah.
Becky, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. You're an absolute legend. Big up yourself.
Love you, Binko. Thank you very much for coming on.
Love you. Bye.
We are drawing to the close of our show, which of course means taking a trip to Death with the Records album cover nightclub. Normally, this is the section where Jamie and I spend some time discussing this week's album cover and whether or not it's making it into our esteemed nightclub. But today, we want to do something a bit different in honour of New Order and in honour of a nightclub they used to own in Manchester. Nope, this isn't Factory, Sankey's, Warehouse Project, or whichever venues are cool now that I probably don't know about. I am, of course, talking about the Hacienda. Situated at 11 to 13 West Whitworth Street, this venue was bankrolled by the success of Joy Division and New Order throughout its life and embodied the experimental flair of Factory Records.
A few weeks after Ian Curtis's death and Joy Division's tour of the East Coast of America was cancelled, Tony Wilson decided to go out to New York anyway and was inspired by the club scene that he found there. Going on nights out to venues like Paradise Garage and Danceteria, he saw no reason why a similar type of place couldn't exist in Manchester. It was from there the idea for the Hacienda was born. Now, Jamie, have you ever been to a nightclub that you'd say would look better in the daytime?
Probably Mama Liz's in Stamford. That's got a cracking interior.
That was a legendary haunt that we were hitting up the other week, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. The Voodoo Lounge downstairs especially, or the Crown Inn in Stockport. That would be my two shouts.
Well, usually for me at least, the whole point of a club is that it looks better with the lights off. You know, we've all been there at the end of the night when you're looking around and thinking, fuck me, this place is disgusting.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, anyway, that is not the kind of place that interior designer Ben Kelly crafted. Honestly, check out some pictures of the club's interior online. It's absolutely beautiful. People would come in just to see the inside. But despite this, logistically, the Hacienda was an absolute joke. The venue was an old boat showroom, so had no acoustic design whatsoever. And I actually heard a hilarious story from the club's first resident, DJ Hugh and Clark, about how 5 minutes before opening night, somebody had a bright idea that they should test out the sound. And apparently, they decided to play this piece of classical music, which, you know, filled every nook and cranny of the room and sounded, you know, so warm and rich and incredible. But then as soon as people came in, and they played anything with a kick drum, the sound was, to quote Gillian Gilbert, like a washing machine. That wasn't the only thing wrong. The layout of the club was terrible. The subterranean DJ booth was hidden so that residents could only see people's ankles. And the main room also had roof lights, so daylight would come in. And for the first few years of its life, this place was absolutely dead. You know, I've spoken to older family friends who went back in the day and it sounded miserable. But then the ecstasy revolution happened in the late 80s and, well, quite simply, everything changed. And I think it's pretty crazy, Jamie, that this club, which is an iconic landmark in Manchester, a symbol of free spirit, hedonism, even the very word Madchester, was so nearly none of those things and relied on the advent of acid house and MDMA.
Yeah, it is crazy. I mean, not to get too meta about it, but maybe it's kind of symbolic of a bigger cultural thing. Post-Thatcher, as you say, everyone's getting on the E's. And for a period in the 90s, life suddenly looked like it was pretty much sorted, that kind of end of history thing. Mm. Obviously, it's all gone downhill since then, but yeah, the 80s versus 90s split is super interesting.
As a side note, would you care to guess which song, or which theme tune, I should say, Hugh and Clark would end every set with?
Which theme tune? I feel like I should probably know this. It's not like the Benny Hill theme song, is it?
No, it's Thunderbirds Are Go.
Oh, wow. Not the Busted version that predates that by about 20 years.
Not the Busted version.
That's obviously what they saw some potential in it as well. That I did not know that. That's crazy.
This is what also I find funny, man. You know, on films like 24 Hour Party People, the Hacienda has this image of being, you know, trendy, so cool, all these amazing musicians, 808 State, a guy called Gerald, whoever. And in reality, at the end of the night, the music that was playing was fucking Thunderbirds Are Go. I mean, that is a bit of a chasm.
Yeah, God, when you put it that way, yeah, it's hard to believe.
Anyway, to move on to the final bit of the episode, we like to imagine a situation where this week's cover is queuing up to get into our nightclub, and Jamie and I are the bouncers. We're judging Power, Corruption and Lies on a few specific criteria. Aesthetics, harmony between music and artwork, originality, and whether or not you could consider this to be an iconic cover. Now, our nightclub is unique in that there's a very strict hierarchy inside. There's different levels to the club. The highest echelon is GOAT, best of the best. Next, we have VIP, so a great cover, but not quite the creme de la creme. Moving down, Ticket on the Door comes next, just about sneaking in. And lastly, Names Not Down, You're Not Coming In. Now, if we're talking about New Order's album covers, there's one person's name we can't not mention. Peter Saville. He was one of Factory's co-founders, he was the label's artistic director, and quite frankly, has designed more iconic album covers than any person, at least I can think of. He was responsible for all of Joy Division and New Order sleeves, artwork for the rest of the Factory stable. He even designed the 2010 England football kit, for crying out loud.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning that we have a video coming out on YouTube soon that takes a deep dive into his work, so probably not going to go into super in-depth onto Saville's life today. But definitely make sure you keep your eyes peeled on the Death With A Record YouTube page for that.
The inspiration for this week's cover came from a day out Saville had at the National Gallery with his then girlfriend.
And he saw Henry Fantin Latour's painting, A Basket of Roses, on a postcard in the gift shop and basically decided it would be perfect. It needs to be said that he and New Order have a very unique working relationship. Strangely, when it came to the artwork, he and the band operated in isolation of one another. Savile rarely would have heard the album, and often New Order wouldn't even see the cover before it was printed. Funnily enough, on this occasion, however, they were shown A Basket of Roses, and all the members liked it. Bernard in particular enjoyed the fact it was of flowers because of the lyric on The Village that we were talking about earlier. However, when Savile actually came down to reproducing the image, he hit a bit of a snag. Because the original painting was so old and delicate, photography was forbidden by the National Gallery. This is where Tony Wilson entered the fray. He got Sir Michael Levy, then director of the National Gallery, on the phone and asked him, well, who actually owns this painting? To which the reply was, the people of Great Britain do. Tony Wilson's response was, well, sir, I believe the people of Great Britain want this painting on New Order's album cover. And the director said, if you put it like that, Mr. Wilson, I'm sure we can make an exception. Anyway, Savile had his design and the public had their album. The painting was reproduced with a contemporary twist in the form of a small colour-coded strip in the top right-hand corner. This wasn't some random bit of colour, but actually gave the LP number using Peter Savile's colour wheel that featured on Factory Records. Definitely check that out if you're interested in his work. It's just a very creative and a very factory way of labelling records. Jamie, Power, Corruption and Lies, our final episode of the series. What are you saying? Are New Order getting into our club for a boogie?
Well, Ollie, I think almost a better question to ask is which New Order and Joy Division covers aren't getting in to our nightclub? And frankly, which aren't on the GOAT level? Because, I mean, let's break this down, right? Unknown Pleasures is obviously getting in, and I'd say obviously GOAT. It's probably one of the strongest GOAT covers you can get, right?
But I remember I remember you slagging that off because, oh, people have it on T-shirts.
No. I think it's an amazing cover. What I dislike is when people have it on a T-shirt and go to a music festival and wear it and be like, hey, guys, I've heard of Joy Division, I've got the T-shirt. It's like, come on, it's you know what I mean? That's what I disliked, but funny you remember that. Anyway, Closer, that's in, right? And I'd say it's probably GOAT as well, no?
Yeah.
Or at least it's pushing on the door. Movement, the same? Is that VIP or GOAT?
It's pushing it. It's pushing it,
there
sure.
You go. I mean, this album, to cut to the chase, I think it's in, and I would say GOAT, and yeah. I'm gonna go that far. Brotherhood would be up there. Technique would be up there. I mean, all of them. You know what I mean?
I was a bit worried that I might have gassed Savile up a bit much there, but I'm glad that you're backing it, because as you say, I'd go GOAT for both Joy Division covers and for Movement and for Power of Corruption and Lies. That seems quite a harmonious way to end the series right there.
Indeed, and I believe our fourth one in the of the series that got in,
yeah,
to,
man,
the GOAT level.
We had Pet Sounds, Mad Villainy, Ladies and Gentlemen, We're Floating in Space, and then Power, Corruption and Lies today.
I have to say, I mean, I love Ladies and Gentlemen, We're Floating in Space, but that one does look slightly out of place in forms of the level, I think, compared to those other three. Maybe I'm going to regret saying that. Do you know what I mean?
I think this is my favourite one of the series.
Yeah, oh, it is amazing. It really, I mean, God bless Peter Savile. Definitely check out that YouTube video we have out on him. Which, unfortunately, wraps up the episode and the series, Ollie. I just want to take a moment to say thank you guys for listening along. I think we've grown quite a bit this series compared to last, so we've got lots of new listeners and lots of new followers over on Instagram. If you're not following us there already, please go and check us out. Same goes for the YouTube channel, as I've mentioned a couple of times. Ollie, do you have any parting words for our lovely, lovely listeners?
Not really. I'm just happy we finally finished this second series. I feel a bit like Sisyphus pushing that rock up a hill, and we've finally got to the top of the hill. So yeah, big up.
Yeah, you are a big Camus man, aren't you? Anyway, on that note, see you guys next series.